Welcome to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media.
Hey guys, it's nice to meet you.
I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. And wait, Glenn, a Star Trek Discovery podcast? I think I watched the wrong thing.
Did you watch the one where Beverly Crusher thinks she's a private detective?
Yeah, she's super bad at it.
Yeah, then you did it right. To celebrate the release of Discovery this week, we revisited a Star Trek The Next Generation episode.
We hope you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed talking about it. And, you know, we're kind of hoping to charm the pants off of you, even though we're still getting our sea legs.
And we hope you'll join us next Tuesday for our discussion of the Discovery premiere.
Until then, stay spacey.
Welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek Discovery podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and I have Star Trek tattoos.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and I always hated Star Trek. Then I watched some.
Together, we're a couple of screw-ups who run a speakeasy in the Jeffries tubes.
This episode, we're talking about Star Trek The Next Generation Season 6, Episode 22, Suspicions.
Suspicions aired on May 10th, 1993. It was written by Joe Manosky and Naren Shankar, and it was directed by Cliff Bohl.
And I liked it.
Well, I didn't.
Okay.
So this is an episode that I have a lot of nostalgia for. Well, I think that's true of every Star Trek The Next Generation episode. But I have a lot of nostalgia for this. But it's written so terribly that I think it's hard to like it on sort of a technical level.
It's not the best writing. It's very different from many other TNG episodes. I'll give you that. And I don't think it's like a rewatch too soon after the first time you've seen it episode. That would drag a little. But on first watch, I was really into it.
Yeah, Suspicions is essentially, it's a hard-boiled detective story, which is something Star Trek The Next Generation does quite a bit, but has done better in, I think, virtually every episode they've done. And really, when I watch this episode now as a rewatch, someone with some distance to it, I have always find myself thinking, this would have been so much better if it was a Dixon Hill episode.
I was going to say, name a better hard-boiled detective episode or an iconic best one, in your opinion.
Any of the Dixon Hill episodes. Yeah, I'm a sucker for all of those. As you know, I mean, I love hard-boiled detective fiction. It's one of my favorite genres.
Were they written well?
I think probably the first Dixon Hill episode, which we get in season one, to my mind, aside from the pilot encounter at Farpoint, that Dixon Hill episode is the only good episode out of that season.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. The Dixon Hill episodes just don't... they don't play to anything that's like deep in my heart. I can see why you would love them. Maybe now that I've seen Veronica Mars, I'll like them more. That's the right angle to come at this from, right?
Yes, it absolutely is. And someday we'll cover a Dixon Hill episode, and I think that'll be fantastic. You'll probably have to restrain my fanboyness a little bit. You might need to bring a taser to that one, or a sedative, or both.
Yeah, I'm not really arguing necessarily, though we'll see what happens, for the quality of the writing or any of the technical aspects of this episode. There's a lot of other stuff in there that just makes it fun for me, and I think really interesting in the Star Trek universe, despite maybe some of its other shortcomings.
Great. Well, so, I'm really looking forward to seeing where we differ on reading some of these scenes, and I would love to leave this episode of our podcast feeling more positive about Suspicions than I am coming into it.
Am I meant to feel more negative at the end of it?
I hope not. You know what? The world doesn't need more negativity. It needs more positivity.
Yeah, it's funny though, because you said as we get through the different scenes, and when I do think about it real quick, the scenes don't all seem that different. It's kind of the same scene over and over for an entire episode.
That is perhaps one of my complaints. But we'll get there when we get there. Should we jump into this episode,
yeah,
Valerie?
Yeah, let's jump in.
All right. The teaser begins in Dr. Crusher's quarters. She's upset about something when Guinan shows up complaining of tennis elbow. Beverly tells her that she can't treat her because she's not a doctor on this ship anymore. And this is supposed to be the dramatic end of the teaser, right? This is supposed to be the hook that makes us want to come back after the commercial. But the camera here goes to Guinan for a reaction shot, and it's terrible. Whoopi Goldberg just sort of looks at the floor. Then the camera goes back to Beverly for a reaction to the reaction or something like that. And it's just, and then it just holds on her face, and it's kind of just inherently right off the bat, it's kind of hokey.
Do we cut to commercial right after the reaction to the reaction?
We do, yeah.
Or, you know, fade to black and then more Netflix.
Yeah, correct.
But yeah, I have to say, so like she said it. She was like, I'm not a doctor on the ship anymore. And I was right there. I was like, what happened? And I was hooked. It worked. They got me. They totally got me. And I also resent the idea that anything Whoopi Goldberg or Guinan did ever was not perfect.
Yeah, me too. I was really surprised. I wondered what, you know, and Cliff Bohl, who directed this episode, is a veteran director. I mean, he's like, I probably has directed more episodes of Next Generation than anyone else. He's just definitely a workhorse. He was really important in developing the Next Generation style. And I was really surprised at what looked to me to be more like bad directing, though it may have been bad editing. You know, they may have not gotten any good shots, or they picked the wrong shot to edit in there. But it just seemed really hokey to me. And I guess really it was more, I think the episode would have benefited from cutting right after she says, I'm not a doctor on this ship anymore, and not give us the reaction shot. I didn't need the reaction shot to be to have the response to it that you were having. And the reaction shot actually undermines my response to it.
Interesting. So first of all, I want to be very clear. What I meant was Whoopi Goldberg / Guinan can do no wrong.
Oh,
I disagree with your reading of it being bad.
Oh, I see.
By virtue of the fact that she can't. So it can't be
right.
Bad.
I'm just trying to say it's not her fault. It was the director's fault.
Yeah, that's a little bit. It's very different.
I'm trying to
I'm
have
saying.
My cake and eat it too. So, and also in this teaser, Valerie, I had a question. How often do you think patients come to Beverly's quarters for treatment instead of going to sick bay? Besides Captain Picard, I mean.
I mean, I think we have seen it. I can't give you any specific examples, but it feels like a thing that isn't that abnormal to me. Also, Guinan is no normal patient. Guinan is Guinan. Guinan knows what's up. We know the second Guinan walks in and does this, that she's not there for the tennis elbow.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, we know that. So I don't think that's not a complaint I have, because she gets a pass to do whatever she wants to do, because she's always right and everyone should listen to her.
Yeah, it's true. She is the bartender, but she gets to go on the bridge whenever she wants. I guess you're right. Guinan goes wherever she wants, whenever she wants. There are no rules for Guinan on this ship.
Yeah, and you just have to trust that whatever she's doing has some sort of greater purpose.
After the break, we're back in Beverly's quarters with Guinan. Beverly has changed into her civilian clothes, her sort of 1993 jumper.
Yes, this is. I was actually wondering, and I don't think it's true, but it made me think of that episode where Troy and Crusher are working out together in, like, they have, like, the is it a unitard?
It
but
is
then
a
with,
unit.
Like, leggings under it. It's very 80s carrying over into the 90s. But I just love the velvet. It's an all velvet outfit that she's wearing.
Yeah.
In the worst colors.
And earth color, earth tones. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks pretty 90s to me. I liked it.
I'd wear it.
So she's in the middle of explaining why she's been relieved of duty. Apparently she's disobeyed orders, violated medical ethics, and caused an interstellar incident. And now she has to go to a starbase for a hearing. As she treats Guinan for tennis elbow, she goes into more detail. At a conference, she heard a Ferengi scientist give a talk about metaphasic shielding. Everyone laughed at him, but Beverly thought his work was brilliant, so she determined to host some kind of scientific gathering on the Enterprise.
Yeah, so, okay, a couple things here. One is, don't think we're not going to talk about Guinan's hat, because obviously I just want to talk about clothes in Star Trek all the time, but Guinan just has the best outfits. But, okay. I think maybe we would benefit a little bit from a discussion of why it's silly a Ferengi would be a scientist, because I feel like that is an underpinning point of the episode. So can you remind me why a Ferengi wouldn't be a scientist?
Yeah, this is a great question. And it is something that's actually discussed in the episode. It's as if the writers, you know, anticipated fan objection to this. And this is something that can be not just... in fact, even in this episode, doesn't just cover Ferengis, covers Klingon, it can cover a variety of these cultures. And part of, you know, so off the blanket answer, of course, is right, that Star Trek has sort of a problem with alien monocultures, where there is not a variety of cultures on the Klingon homeworld or in the Klingon Empire. Same is true with Ferengi and all sorts of other aliens, you know, very different from our own experience of Earth, which, you know, has had, you know, tens of thousands of cultures.
I think they do this. This is a weird problem I have with linguistics, with language also in the Star Trek universe, that they're an entire planet, that all planets have one language.
Yeah, that's right.
Which doesn't make any sense to me ever.
No, it doesn't make any sense. It's a real problem that Star Trek has, except that it's just something that we have to accept that that's how Star Trek works in order to get to the real, you know, the real reason we're here, which is to, you know, watch a TV episode that asks us hard questions about ourselves and our society. But the Ferengi, of course, are characterized always as being cutthroat, sort of, you know, robber barons, 19th century, 18th century capitalists, and nothing else. In the same way that the Klingons are always presented to us as being warriors and nothing else, one wonders how they have, you know, plumbing or heating or food if people are only warriors or people are only merchants.
Yeah, so I think of the Ferengi as greedy. That would be like the first, right?
That's right.
Adjective to come to mind. But why can't they be greedy and also smart? Why can't they be greedy with their smart? You know, like, I feel like this Ferengi character is presented as not very Ferengi at all versus a Ferengi who's also a scientist.
Probably the answer to your question, Valerie, is that in Star Trek's conception of humans, human values, human attitudes, you can't be greedy and search for knowledge at the same time. That those are values that are antithetical to each other. And if you are a scientist, you're questing for knowledge, you're inherently going to not be a greedy person. That might be more problematic, but I think it definitely at Star Trek's conception of if you are someone whose primary motivation is money, then you are not going to become a scientist.
Right. Greedy in sense of money, because I was thinking you could still be greedy in terms of wanting to gather fame or notoriety.
Yes, and that's like the plot of, I don't know, 17% of Star Trek episodes is the scientist who is kind of a megalomaniac.
So I think what we're getting into here, I think we're getting, we should go back to the recap, but this is what I'm going to want to talk to you about this episode. What I love about this episode is that we have all of these different cultures that exist in the Star Trek universe put into a room together and have their like most basic Star Trek defined traits have to interact with each other. And I love it. I know it is reductive, but I love it.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. And I'm looking forward to getting to that point. So, all right, Beverly and Guinan in Beverly's quarters, they're talking. At this point, the camera moves to another scene while we continue to get Beverly's narration over it. And just in case it isn't clear that we're about to go into a flashback, her voice also gets all echoey so that we know we're traveling back in time. But when we come out of the voiceover, we're at some science station on the Enterprise where four scientists have arrived to see a demonstration of the shielding. Voiceover Beverly tells us who they are. Kurok, a Klingon. T'Pan, the director of the Vulcan Science Academy. T'Pan's human husband. And Joe Brill, a Takarian. And then, of course, there's Dr. Rega, the Ferengi.
Does the husband get unnamed?
No, he has a name. It's Christopher. We hear it here. It's just interesting here that he seems sort of, like he's kind of second fiddle
to
her.
Yeah, he's a trophy husband.
And he is a trophy husband. I do quite like, you know, this is Spock's parents inverted, right? Spock's parents are Vulcan, very important Vulcan male who really likes human ladies.
I don't know if that's how most people would describe that. But
well, he's had at least two human wives over the course of the show.
Well, then the only logical conclusion
that
he really likes human ladies.
I think it's the only logical conclusion. But I do like it here that we get that inverted.
Okay, so yeah, we have all these people in a room together, and...
Yeah, so then voiceover Beverly goes away, and we're left to watch the scene. T'Pan explains why this shielding matters, right? She tells us it will allow a ship to fly into a star's corona. And Rega, the Ferengi scientist, wants to develop the shield, but he doesn't have the resources, so he's willing to sell the rights to it. All he wants is the recognition. He wants the fame, the glory that science can bring. Now, these other scientists are super skeptical. So Rega is going to demonstrate his new technology by flying a shuttle into a star.
Cue my series of questions, which is just I think my role here. But okay, so we see them test this metaphasic shielding twice in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that mean it's already developed? What resources does he need? It seems to be fully functioning.
Yeah, I also have that question. Okay. I mean, so it's not, he doesn't need the resources to develop the technology, to figure out the technology. Right, it is what he says, but I think what he means is to mass produce it.
Yeah, it's a scaling issue.
I think that's what we're meant to understand. But again, this is one of the places where I have issues with this episode, is that the... the plot devices for this hard-boiled detective story are real flimsy. Mm-hmm. It's real clear. I'm guilty of this myself in my own writing of hard-boiled detective stories, of envisioning scenes between characters that I want, and then trying to construct plot devices to make those scenes happen. But I think they've done a real bad job of it here. And a particular problem that you have in detective stories is motivating characters. Characters have to have reasons to commit crimes. And this motivation here for Dr. Rega, or this motivation here really for, not for Dr. Rega to be working on the science, but this motivation here for Dr. Rega to be, to need all these other scientists to come to the Enterprise is pretty flimsy.
I really enjoyed this episode, but I think that he didn't want them there. I feel like Crusher really manipulated this whole situation. Like, I don't know. I think we're meant to believe she had, right, the scientific diplomacy in
That's
mind,
right.
But I don't think she did it well, or like really had the like full consent of everyone there.
No, I agree. And just thinking about this as you know, from a writing perspective of how I might have changed this to make it seem more believable, I probably would have altered Rega's motivation, one, to be a little more in line with Ferengis as we see them, to make him appear very confident with this technology. But what he's trying to do actually is to just sell it to them,
yeah.
Not because he wants, not because he's incapable of producing it, but because what he wants is just to sell the patent to it, and that these people are there to bid on them. And their motivations, of course, are to try to get the lowest price. I feel like that would have been one, that would have been a stronger plot element for the detective story, and two, that would have been a lot more Ferengi like.
Yeah, and then we could have had a scene, like a bidding scene, like on the stock floor, where just have all these characters suddenly like shouting numbers.
Right. 17 bars of latinum.
Yeah. Gold plated.
Yes, I'm gonna shout that at somebody on the street today. All right. So Kirak, the Klingon scientist, is worried about being scammed. So she demands that someone other than Rega fly it. And Joe Brill, the Takarian, volunteers. And that's the end of that scene.
I wanna know why a person has to be in the shuttle. Send a probe with a metaphasic shield. Why does it this seems like really irresponsible to have this technology that we're basically saying isn't tested. We don't know what's going to happen. We know that super dangerous, you might die to fly into a star's corona, but let's put a person in there to test it anyway, even though like we have starships. So clearly we also have a way of remote piloting something.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a really great observation that I did not make. That did not occur to me. But you're right. We as humans now in our space programs, or at least the American space program, would never do this, right? Next generation people, Star Trek people, are supposed to value life even more than we do. So this does, you're right, this seems totally out of character for this culture.
And also, there's just not enough background information. Like, has he tested this before with a probe? Has he ever? It seems like he's never tested this before. He's just very confident that it works. And we're going to put a living creature that might, burn up and die? Is that what happens when you fly into a star's corona?
Probably. We should probably send someone into a star's corona and
no,
find out.
We should send a probe. Or like a bottle of Tang or something.
Right.
I don't know. But so that really was a red flag for me. It felt really confusing and just, yeah, so irresponsible. And at this point, you know, I didn't remember this episode, so I was watching it like anew. And I thought, oh, this is going to be why she is in trouble, is because she let humanoid kill himself. Like, she allowed this to happen. She didn't say this is irresponsible, we should do some other tests first. That's what I thought the problem was going to be, because it's such an obvious problem.
It is, and I feel like there should be an awful lot of paperwork involved. There doesn't seem to be.
Oh no! There's no more alcohol. Everybody's vegetarian, and there's no more paperwork in the Next Generation universe.
I don't think that's the future I want to live in.
Synth paperwork.
Brilliant. Let's pause the recording of this episode and go copyright that now.
Done. And we're back.
All right. So the next scene, Beverly and Rega do a West Wing style walk and talk in the Enterprise corridor. And we learn that T'Pan, the Vulcan scientist, has been working on a technology that's very similar to Rega's metaphasic shielding. And Beverly suspects that she's jealous.
I mean, but she's Vulcan. Does she get jealous? Vulcans get super jealous. That's the problem, right? Vulcans feel too much, which is why they feel nothing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But it is, you're right. I think at this point in Star Trek, we haven't had Star Trek Enterprise yet that really takes that up as a theme with its Vulcans. So right. I wonder how people responded to that line when this aired, actually.
Like, is it too unbelievable?
Yeah, I wonder. I wish I'd sort of thought of it before we started recording, because it would have been interesting to go back and look at the bulletin board system from 1993 to see what serious business Star Trek fans had to complain about with this episode. Though, in 2017, we should not read internet comments. That's probably true in 1993 as well. From the bridge's view screen, we watch Joe Brill's test flight. He gets right up on that star, but then he starts to have trouble breathing, and there's interference on the screen. The Enterprise beams him to sickbay, where Beverly tries to save him, but she can't, and he dies.
And we don't know what's wrong with him, because we just know he went blurry.
That's right.
We don't, like, you would think if you fly into a star's corona, you'd be, like, melting or something, you know, not just blurry.
not just it wouldn't just be that your TV is going on the fritz.
Interference isn't the problem here. Something's happening and he's dying, and if it's in a star's corona, you think there might be some physical changes.
Yeah, he sort of more looks like he's having a heart attack or a stroke while he's doing this. But it's, you know, so they don't know what happened. So Beverly goes and she does an autopsy on Joe Brill, and she discovers that Takarians don't have discrete organs, so she surmises that whatever killed him must have occurred at the cellular level.
Okay, Star Trek autopsy question time. You don't touch the body at all? You just sit under a piece of metallic fabric and there's some scanners?
Yeah, I mean, that's how Star Trek medicine works. Everything is non-invasive.
Okay.
Unless you've got a fake heart like Captain Picard does.
This that you made that point, I will remind you of. That's a sentence later when I have another question.
Ooh, okay, fantastic.
Great.
So after doing the autopsy, Beverly doesn't find any cause of death, right? And there's very little cellular decay. So she's frustrated, and Captain Picard shows up and very, very creepily tries to comfort her.
Oh, I disagree. Really? You thought it was creepy?
It seemed real creepy to me. His hand on her shoulder.
Oh, I read that so differently. I thought it was so tender. I thought it was really beautiful. Like, I noticed that the way that the main characters address each other in this episode, just like, be still my heart. She calls him Jean-Luc in a really tender way. He calls her Beverly. Later, we see Riker for like half a second mm-hmm. in the episode, and he addresses her as Beverly, I believe.
Yeah, and she calls him Will.
Mm-hmm. And again, there's a literally touching moment where she, I think, puts her hand on his chest.
Yeah.
When she's refusing whatever it is he's asking her to do or feel or whatever. But I just thought it was a beautiful moment because Picard and Crusher have a relationship that is different. Picard doesn't call people really by their first name.
No, I mean, big discussion, of course, about whether or not they have a romantic relationship. I believe that they do. Certainly at this point, I believe for sure that they do, or at least that they would like to, that they have this intense emotional relationship that neither, you know, that they would like to turn into something more.
At the very least, they have history and a depth of feeling for each other.
Yeah, they absolutely do. But I wanted this scene to read to me to be touching. I wanted to ship this scene very much, mm-hmm. but it just seemed like it was acted very differently than that, or perhaps the direction mm-hmm. they received. Again, I'll put it back on the director.
No, I disagree. It totally got me. I was like, oh, they like each other. And it felt like a break from how they might typically interact because no one was around or he was really worried about her. Like, Picard doesn't touch people on the shoulder. It's not a thing.
No, he doesn't. And I think, and the camera zooms in on his hand, and I think it's the way that the camera is showing his hand that to me reads as creepy. It feels like it's the way you shoot that scene when you're making a horror movie. and so it's not anything with the acting. I think it's entirely about that shot that sets up, because that happens before he says anything to her. And that just sets up the way I'm then responding to the talky bits. And just reading the whole thing as creepy. But I think you're right. Probably the flaw is with me.
No, not necessarily. I think maybe we just have very different ideas of romance. And mine's a bit creepier, I guess. I just learned it by myself.
Yeah, I'm happy to help you with some Star Trek therapy.
Thanks. All right, up next.
All right, next scene. Next scene, Geordi and Data investigate the shuttle with Dr. Rega. Everything checks out, but Geordi says that even still, something must have gone wrong with the shielding. And Rega gets very angry, very defensive.
This felt like all of a sudden there was, a writing decision or a directorial decision that the Ferengi was going to be a Ferengi now and, you know, have explosive emotions that couldn't be contained, which didn't seem in character with Rega throughout the rest of the episode. Maybe it's a comment on like, oh, he's a little bit better containing himself as a Ferengi than other Ferengi unless he gets pushed. And so now we're seeing this other part of his character. But it didn't make sense to me. I didn't believe he would get angry.
Yeah, I agree. Prior to this, he seemed very calm, very altruistic even, at least for a Ferengi. And yeah, now we're having the burst of emotions. Beverly's gathered the scientists again in the science station on the Enterprise. She's telling them that she's going to call off the tests. Rega is really unhappy about this. He wants to pilot a test flight himself, and he begs for permission to be allowed to, but Beverly says no. Rega, very angry, storms out, determined to prove himself and his work.
Yeah, so this is, again, it's like all of a sudden we're concerned about, I keep trying not to say human life, humanoid, I guess, about life. Like, no, we were not going to do that. That's dangerous. It was really dangerous before, too. We shouldn't have let the other guy do it either.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one thing here, you know, getting back to the question of sort of how does paperwork function here, you know, Beverly invokes her authority as the medical officer. She's the one who can, it turns out, we learn in this episode that the chief medical officer on the spaceship can say that she thinks something is too dangerous and she has the final authority there.
Yeah.
Which I think is very, very interesting. I don't know if we'll see that again in Star Trek. I mean, we see the doctors telling the captains they need to sleep and go on vacation all the time, but I don't know.
I think we've seen doctors tell captains they straight up can't do something. And there are instances of doctors being the final word on someone not being able to go do a thing. That's happened before.
Yeah, it's definitely happened before, but to my mind, it's all happened telling the captain personally that something can't happen. Like, you can't go on that away mission or you can't do anything because you need a vacation sort of thing, as opposed to just seeing the chief medical officer interact, like circumventing the captain.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Which is sort of what we see here. I do find it was cool. That was a good part of this scene. All right. So we go to the next scene. Rega is dead. He appears to have shot himself, but there is something suspicious. And Beverly is going to prove that it was murder.
So, one thing that I noticed in this episode that was striking when the first person died, and just therefore all the more striking after the second person dies, is that nobody really seems upset that someone's died. You know, like there's no, I don't know even how to explain it. It's like it's all being taken too lightly. And maybe that's a little bit of my thing. Like, they shouldn't put a humanoid in the shuttle to begin with. And then that humanoid dies and everyone's like, okay, all right, let's figure out what went wrong. Not like, oh my God, we just killed that guy.
Yeah, there's no empathy for Joe Brill's death at all.
And even now, you could argue that there's empathy for Rega's death in the sense that she like she gets a sense of purpose to figure it out, but it's not empathetic feeling. It doesn't come from an emotional reaction to death. It's very like cut and dry.
Yeah, it's a puzzle for her to solve. Mm-hmm. You know, this is now is the inciting incident for the hard-boiled detective part of the story, and for her, it is not about an emotional response to Rega's death, or at least not a wish that he hadn't died, and a need to find justice for him as a way to honor his life. It's all about her wanting to solve a puzzle.
Right, and this again runs counter to what you said earlier, is that the Star Trek universe is supposed to be about having even greater value for life than we do presently, theoretically, right? So, and this is just not happening here.
Yeah, not present in this episode, really, anywhere. All right, next scene, Beverly goes to Captain Picard, and Captain Picard tells her that she can't perform an autopsy on Rega because of Ferengi funerary customs.
Now, that's not what he says, and this is why I asked that autopsy question earlier, and people can't see me, but I am pointing at Glenn mm-hmm. and wagging my finger. he says, you can't touch the body. That's what he says. You can't touch the body before the death ritual.
Oh, that's right. That you're right, because that's the custom that he's pointing to, is that is a sense that the body can't be violated, so you can't cut into right. it. But that's not
as
how
we saw earlier with Joe Brill.
Yep.
Joe Brill's autopsy. You didn't have to touch him to do it. And so the only way is to interpret touch as violate or interact with at all, right? Disturb, maybe. But what Picard actually says is touch, and you don't need to touch the body to do an autopsy. So I'm confused.
That's a great observation, Valerie. And I think that's really interesting, because clearly the problem here from the production side is that the director or the producer, maybe both together, have chosen, when they were deciding how to show the autopsy of Joe Brill, wanted to show, I don't know, a cool space future way of doing it, or didn't want to spend the money to do effects of actually cutting into a body, and forgot that later on we get this clear indication that that is how that we do autopsies, by touching the body.
Right. And as will become apparent when we figure out the mystery at the end of this episode, we couldn't have cut into Joe Brill's body and had the plot work.
Oh, yes, that's right. Of course.
So there's a lot of holes that any which way you rearrange them still arrive at a problem. But I think it could have been solved by saying, like, the body cannot be disturbed or, like, thought of in a medical way because it needs to be respected. But the way they have Picard phrase what he says she can't do, she never technically breaks what he says.
Yeah, well, at the end of it, everything works out, and she's back to being a doctor on this ship. And so probably maybe this is what she argued at her hearing.
Yeah, we'll get back.
I'm not touching you. I'm not touching you.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So good. Always works every time.
Well, at this point, Beverly is not thinking about it on these terms, but she is thinking that there are some other technical ways that she can get around this and go about being a hard-boiled detective. So even if she can't perform an autopsy, she can still interrogate people. First up, she goes to visit T'Pan and her husband, Christopher, and they get upset at Beverly's accusations. But eventually, Christopher confesses that he overheard Kurok threaten Rega. Beverly is really bad at interrogating people or doing detective work. Her questions are all, hey, so, guys, did you see anything suspicious? Do you guys maybe know who murdered Rega?
Are you sure you don't know who murdered Rega, though?
Okay, I'm going to ask one more time, might get a lollipop.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm, because I have so many questions, it is really coming off as if I share your negativity, I think, for this episode, but, I am just so enjoying watching so many different Star Trek cultures interact in one episode that, you know, I pay no mind. But she is not a good detective. She's a very bad detective. And yeah, at this point, I'm still like, who done it? I'm, you know, we talked about this in the last episode of that I didn't feel like I was along for the ride, right? Like I wasn't getting enough information in the right order to be intrigued, but still like have a sense that maybe I could figure it out. And this episode is totally giving it to me. I'm like, what is it? Who did it? Did they do it? Look at T'Pan's face. She totally did it. And so I'm having fun at this point.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're right. I think there's actually some really great, this had the potential anyway to be a really great scene. And I do quite like T'Pan and her human husband, Christopher, together here, because as you say, we do get shown Vulcan culture and human culture being very different. That we get T'Pan, the Vulcan, being cold and logical. She invokes logic to poke holes into Beverly's very bad questions. And Christopher is the one who gets, succumbs to his human emotions and gets very upset. And I didn't think about this watching the episode now for our coverage of it. But, you know, in 1993, you know, this is a scene that would have been happening probably, you know, on two other TV shows that week, on maybe Murder, She Wrote and Columbo or some other mystery show. And in each of those scenes, it would have been, you know, the husband was the calm, collected one, and the wife is the one who's, you know, losing it, might, you know, getting hysterical. In fact, might even be the way that we would have thought of that. And this really inverts these gender dynamics here. In a way that didn't occur to me now, because I've kind of forgotten that we used to live in a world that had those gender dynamics.
Well, they're still there, Glenn. Never forget. I don't know. I think that's a very interesting point, but I don't know if I agree with, like, just the general reading of the scene, because I can tell that Tapan under the surface is having a bit of a harder time than Christopher is. May I call him Chris?
I mean, you'll have to ask him.
Is it too informal? Sorry, Chris. Because I actually think that they did it a little bit incorrectly for the cultures of the characters. You're reading like, oh, this makes sense. Like, that's how a Vulcan would act. That's how a human act. I think the human would be more likely to lie and the Vulcan more likely to be obligated to tell the truth about what happened. Right? Because the truth, I don't think you've recapped it yet, is they saw the Klingon scientist arguing with Rhaega.
Yeah, right. Though I don't know, actually, to your point there, I don't know that they both did. I think it's he did, and maybe he didn't tell his wife.
No. She knew. Because there's a point where she says, like, don't. Like,
oh, you're right.
Or are you sure, Chris, side eye, like, don't tell Crusher the thing I know you're about to tell Crusher. Maybe they didn't see it together, but, you know, as husband and wife, they shared the information between them. But I would just think that a Vulcan would be more likely to tell the truth and just tell it very matter-of-factly. Like, this is a thing that happened. I don't think it's very consequential to your investigation because this is Klingon temperament. And the human would be more likely to lie. And they've reversed that here. The Vulcan is trying to hide something, which wouldn't be my immediate first thought for a Vulcan.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That didn't occur to me either. I'm really enjoying getting these readings on these scenes. You're making some very shrewd observations, and this is definitely one of them. If we combine this with Beverly's really nonchalant statement about how she assumes T'Pon is jealous earlier, it's possible that the writers weren't thinking very clearly about Vulcans at this point.
I think a lot of people have problems with they think Vulcans are one way and have problems with, like, the consistency with which they are not represented. But I do, though, subscribe to the philosophy that Vulcans are actually very multifaceted. And I find that very interesting. Like, there's a cultural set of things they're meant to subscribe to, but they battle that all in different ways. So, but in terms of what you might standard think Vulcan human, I don't think this scene did it right.
Yeah, I agree. And I think just thinking about how, you know, how I would have written this episode, which, and hopefully someday I'll get to write a Star Trek episode. That would be a dream come true.
Yeah.
I think Vulcans, I don't have anything specific to say here other than to say that Vulcans are really complicated characters to write, because we need all our characters need to be motivated, and our motivations, especially in a murder mystery, tend to be rooted in emotions. And so I think this was a tough task for a writer to write about a Vulcan who possibly has murdered a Ferengi scientist on this ship. I think it's a tough task. So I don't mean to be, coming down too hard on the writers of this episode. I think they had a hard task in front of them. But I think it's great to sort of point out these things.
Yeah. And it was a hard task, but again, I still, in the end, I enjoyed watching all these cultures interact and seeing what they did. And at this point, as an audience member, I'm like, T'Pon totally did it.
Yeah, and
I'm
convinced. Which I think is interesting, because I think we're supposed to believe this story that Christopher tells and think now that Kurok did it. And this is certainly, we can move into our next scene now, because this is certainly what Beverly thinks. So she goes and confronts Kurok. Kurok is in a lab, and she's suspiciously looking at Rhaega's data. Beverly, in her interrogation here, also does a pretty bad job of interrogating Kurok, but she pushes Kurok's buttons with some hard-boiled tough talk that seemed not quite right coming out of Dr. Beverly Crusher.
Yeah.
As a result, Kurok gets, you know, Klingon mad and shoves her around a bit. But Beverly stands her ground. She's a real tough one. And eventually Kurok answers Beverly's questions, but she doesn't really get a whole lot out of her.
Right. Yeah, she doesn't stand her ground. She falls over a bunch in this scene.
Sure, she does literally fall over. She metaphorically stands her ground.
With a lot of very dramatic, like, hair flips and then intense eyes into the camera. Yeah, this scene didn't really throw me off. I think it was meant to, but I feel like I know Klingons well enough to know that they're passionate people, and this anger is, you know, it could have been over, like, you ate my, what do they eat? Grop, glock, what are the worms?
Yep, you got it.
Which one of it? You know what I mean.
I'm not sure what the worms are.
Like, you ate my gross Klingon food or something. You know, a Klingon would flip a table and be like, I'm captain of the ship now, in reaction to, you know, he stole my sandwich. So this doesn't surprise me. But I will say that I actually think that the Klingon scientist is the most interesting character in this episode. I really like her. She's beautiful, and her outfit is awesome, especially because we normally see Klingon women in very revealing outfits. They're, you know, like they're sexually empowered and powerful women. And she, for a Klingon, is a little bit more tame. She has this really cool science lady dress, and she's smart. I like her a lot.
And I think the actress who plays Kirak does an excellent job. I think she's probably the of the guest actors on the show this week, she's the one who does the best job.
She had the best makeup too. I really liked. I don't think it's normal for the Klingon makeup, but they didn't put her nose all the way down, so the bottom of her nose has like two ridges, and it's her makeup is just beautifully done.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that.
She's a very interesting Klingon.
So at this point, voiceover Beverly returns to tell us that she still doesn't know anything at this point. So instead, she's just going to have to do that autopsy after all, even if it means she'll get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Even though she doesn't actually touch the body. Yeah, this feel, again, like it feels a little bit out of character, but okay, sure, I'm with you. Sure, Beverly, you just have to do it. Let's go.
All right. With the autopsy complete, Beverly goes to visit Captain Picard, and she tells him what she's done. And this is where Beverly is relieved of duty. So back in the present, Beverly and Guinan are still hanging out in Beverly's quarters, and Beverly whines about being powerless to prove that something fishy is going on because she's been relieved of duty, but Guinan encourages her to keep on sleuthing anyway.
Yeah, I want to go back to the scene with Picard because, again, I think it was tender again, and tender in a different way. Like, what does it look like when you have two people who really do care about regulations and respect? One of the people has broken those regulations and been disrespectful to another culture, which is a foundation principle of the Star Trek universe at this point. But they care about each other a lot and are going to have this very difficult discussion. I don't know. I thought it was a really tender moment. Also, this is where we see Picard has this really cool space desk in his quarters. I don't think we've ever seen it before. Have you seen this desk before?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if we have seen it before, but I did. You're right. I really enjoyed just the set that they're in when they're having this conversation.
My first thought was, where are we? Is there a second ready room? What's going on? Because I hadn't seen this desk of his before, and it has a sick space painting behind him on the desk.
Yeah, a lot of bedroom scenes in this episode, and I think that's interesting because you know, as you were pointing out earlier, that there's a lot of first names, there's a lot of touching. You know, it seems like kind of one of the underlying but also understated motifs of this episode is to show the intimacy among these characters.
Yeah, no, I would agree, and I think that is heightened by the fact that a lot of the other main crew members aren't in the episode very much, and they only come in from the direct viewpoint of needing to have a kind of intimate or intense moment with Beverly, and then we don't see that we don't linger on them at all. So Picard has these very specific roles. That scene with Riker that we're gonna get to is a very specific role. Or maybe the Riker scene already happened?
Yes, it did happen. I skipped it because it was just a little 20-second scene, but you're right, it happens when she's on her way to go do the autopsy.
So yeah, he's trying to tell her not to do it. The way that the other characters kind of move in and out of the episode is, I think, very intimate and dramatic.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that and told me about it. It really has enhanced my appreciation of the episode for sure. All right, so motivated now by Guinan, Beverly gets back to being a detective. She goes and talks to Data to rule out sabotage, and she learns that the only way someone could have affected the shielding would have been to aim a phased ionic pulse at it from the Enterprise. And this would have caused a temporary malfunction, which in turn would have left traces in Joe Brill's body.
I have some science questions, but I don't think they're...
I think we all do.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So Beverly goes back to sickbay to look at Joe Brill's autopsy data, but now that she's been relieved of duty, she can't access them. Fortunately, Nurse Ogawa is there. She comes to the rescue. She pulls up the files and even helps Beverly do a new scan of Jobril's body. Not touching, just a scan, right, as you pointed out. And this time, Beverly finds what she's looking for. Someone definitely fired a phased ionic pulse at the shuttle.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable to me, too, that the nurse would be an accomplice here. Though I did think, well, maybe that's not true. It was kind of a beautiful moment to illuminate the relationship that they must have. And the nurse being like, man, if Beverly is like, this is bugging her this much, it must be really important and worth throwing away my entire career.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this, again, is a place where we see more intimacy. And I think we're seeing Beverly as kind of a warm character that people really care about, even if she was the worst mom possible to Will Wheaton.
And it's interesting because in this episode, and maybe this was what was keeping you or giving you a different opinion than mine, is that she's not coming off as a warm character. She's not in a good mood when she's narrating this episode.
No, she's not, and she's trying to be hard boiled, and it's hard to be hard boiled and tender at the same time. I've tried.
Yeah, you're right. It's always failed. But other people are still being tender towards her, even if she seems a bit out of character. But, you know, it's also okay if you read these scenes differently.
I read them. I am now reading them the way you are. So I'm really grateful for you pointing them out. All right. Now we move to the bridge where Deanna is expressing some concern about Beverly. But this isn't a Deanna episode. So she's very quickly interrupted when Beverly takes off in Rega's shuttle, determined to replicate the experiment. Now, I'm very confused by this. Replicating the experiment won't do anything to identify Rega's killer. This is not how you solve the mystery. The only thing this will do is prove that the shield works, and I don't know what that's supposed to prove, right? So at this point, Beverly is putting her medical license in jeopardy, probably risking going to space jail just to prove that the scientist that Rega was right, not to find his killer. And I think this undermines the motivation that we've been shown previous to this. So I think it's bad detective writing.
It's also, you know, you're like, oh, maybe she'll go to space jail. Oh, maybe she'll die. Like,
also,
again,
maybe she'll
again,
die.
This is like, it seems like nobody's talking about all the people that are dead and how dangerous this is. And like, that's to me like the biggest deal here. You're like, well, maybe she'll go to space jail. No, maybe she will die. In fact, most likely she will die because that's what happened last time somebody did the exact same thing that can't really be that different 2 days later.
At this point, there's a 100% fatality rate for flying into the sun.
Yes. But yeah, you're right. It's confusing. I definitely was like, oh, she has to do this to prove that Rega was right. And, you know, that felt cool to me, and so I forgot about there was this huge plot hole and like things weren't in a straight line, so fair point. Yeah, it doesn't really have anything to do with solving the murder. It's like as soon as she realizes that somebody messed with the shielding, she stops caring about the murder mystery and just goes back to wanting to prove the shielding works, which was her original motivation in getting these scientists together in the beginning of the episode anyway.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm just not. Yeah, it just seems it's weakly plotted. All right. On board the shuttle, Jobril climbs out of a crate, very much not actually dead, apparently. So Takarians, it turns out, are able to mimic death on the cellular level. He gives a villainous monologue explaining the plot. And he tells us he wanted to steal the metaphasic shield for himself so that he could turn it into a weapon.
Does he need to pretend to die to do that? I don't really understand.
Yeah, again, his scheme doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. This was not the plan he showed up on board the Enterprise with because he didn't know he was going to get to fly it. His initial plan was just to find a way to steal Rega's data and, you know, then go back to his homeworld and turn it all into a weapon. This was kind of a crime of opportunity where he thought that he could fake his own death.
But what was he going to do if Beverly didn't decide to pilot the shuttle? So once Beverly decides to pilot the shuttle again and he's somehow escaped from the morgue and
right.
found his way
worry about that.
Into a crate on the shuttle without anyone noticing, which is like the first problem, you know, then it's like, okay, he gives his villainous explanation, and then he kills Beverly and he flies away with the shuttle, and therefore he steals it and develops it into a weapon. But there's a lot of waiting around for an opportunity for that shuttle to go out again that he has to do for his plan to work at all.
Yeah, he might actually be a worse criminal than Beverly is a detective. It's not, yeah, the mystery plot stuff is not good, not strong in this episode. And it's actually just about to get worse, in fact. So Joe Brill and Beverly struggle. Beverly shoots him, but then he regenerates. So she turns up the setting and disintegrates him, right? So now there's no evidence for what happened, no one to confess to the murder. This is not good detective work. Like, what does she do when she gets back on the Enterprise? She's like, guys, you're never going to believe this. And I mean, you're really never going to believe this because there's no footage and there's no body. But guys, check it out. Here's what happened.
Yeah, no, it yes. Like, I can't. I'm just so glad that you also had this reaction. I mean, the way the episode deals with it is it doesn't. Episode over now. Because the audience understands what happened. And I guess Beverly gets to be a doctor because we think she's still good at it.
Yeah, because it turns out we, the audience, 400 years in the past, are the final authority on whether or not Beverly gets to still be a doctor on this ship.
I mean, she should not still be allowed to be a doctor.
No.
I mean, I guess she is still going to the hearing. We've seen...
Yes, she does still have to go to the hearing. We just...
Because she still did all the stuff that...
Yeah, she still did all the stuff. I mean, maybe, you know, it's the future. Everyone has to have a, you know, make some contribution to society. And I don't know, maybe the hearing said, well, if she can't be a doctor, she's going to try to be a private eye. And she's terrible at that. So we yeah. should let her keep being a doctor.
Yeah, the lesser of two evils. I also, again, this goes back to, like, the probe. Like, why can't we just send a probe? Isn't technology better than this? Isn't technology better than, oh, the first shot didn't work, I guess I have to kill him? Can't we, like, stun him? Is there not some phase in the middle? Or can we, like, shoot something around him that, you know, don't they have in space jail? We see in Star Trek there's just like a see-through shield that goes up that traps people in a place. We yeah. can't have that.
There are many similar plots, you know, physical struggles on shuttles in various Star Trek shows that end with someone very cleverly putting up that shield to separate the two halves of the right. shuttle. Yeah, no, it's weak writing.
Counterpoint.
Yeah,
it was really cool though when he had that whole shot.
Oh,
him.
It did look real.
It was
cool.
Super cool.
Yeah, it did look. It did look super cool. That was like the best. Yeah, although actually that might be a new effect from the remasters, which is what we watched.
Either
on
way,
Netflix,
I was like,
but it looked pretty.
Whoa,
good.
Whoa, he's yeah. got a hole in him. Like, yeah, there was really some like base things that this episode was appealing to in me that allowed me to enjoy it.
So we've got one more scene left. We have an epilogue. Somehow Beverly's been reinstated, and it's all because Guinan encouraged her to keep detecting. She goes to visit Guinan at her post in 10 Forward, and she has a present. It's a state-of-the-art tennis racket, so Guinan won't get tennis elbow anymore. That's just one problem. Guinan doesn't play tennis. She never has.
And we never see Guinan again.
I know. This is the last appearance of Guinan until her brief appearance in Generations.
Yeah, she really just, you know, went out with a bang. We learn she doesn't actually play tennis, and thus the Guinan character has peaked.
Yeah, she's peaked. She's peaked. Once you know whether or not someone plays tennis, there's not really anything more you can do with that character.
So many relationships in my life have ended because I learned whether or not they played tennis. I do want to know about, like, gift giving in the Star Trek universe when, like, you don't have to buy it.
She's no,
like,
well, she just replicated
tennis
it.
Racket. Why would you replicate anything other than the state-of-the-art tennis racket?
Isn't this exactly the racket Guinan would have been using? Because if you ask the replicator to make you a tennis racket, isn't it just going to make you the best tennis racket?
Yeah.
Or is there some component of this tennis racket that can't be replicated? It's made of gold-pressed latinum.
Yeah, or, like, I don't know, she bought it on some other planet with... I don't it doesn't make any sense. Like, I was just like, I don't understand. This isn't, I guess it's the thought that counts.
It's the thought that counts. Yeah. I mean, this is a question we always have when people are giving gifts in Star Trek, and we just have to suspend our disbelief about it a little bit. So, and speaking of suspending our disbelief, I do want to say, so you have not completely turned me around on this episode. And, you know, I don't want to come to these episodes and be critical, and I don't want to come to these episodes to poke fun at them, even though I have just spent an hour doing exactly that. But this episode in particular, you know, because I love this genre, I write stories in this genre, I was really approaching this with trying to learn something about how to write stories in this genre by poking holes by seeing what's wrong with this one. So that was really the way I was approaching this. So I'm really am very grateful that you had a much more positive attitude in reading of this episode. And you've shown me some things that I really missed. I think this intimacy reading that you had was really fantastic.
Yeah, I don't disagree with your points. I think they just didn't get in the way for me of enjoying the episode. And I was there for the journey. I was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? Who did it? I really enjoyed that. I loved what was being done with having so many different cultures in one space. I loved their outfits and their personalities. I love that there was a Ferengi that didn't annoy me. And I love asking these questions of the Star Trek universe, those moments when you're shouting at the TV and you're like, but that has nothing to do with anything. Or like, where was the other tennis racket? Like, that is a huge, huge part of my enjoyment of the show. I do have a really important question for you, which is, whose mouth scares you more, a Ferengi or a Klingon?
Oh, wow. Definitely a Ferengi mouth.
It's pointier?
It's way pointier, yes. I have not an intense, but a mild physical revulsion to the Ferengi makeup, which is good, like we're supposed to. So they've done a good job with it. Whereas with Klingons, I don't think I've ever felt repulsed by Klingons. I definitely don't want to encounter a Klingon, you know, anywhere, ever. They're big, scary people.
But do you like to have your ears caressed?
I think that's going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. And you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com.
Drop us a note and let us know what you thought of Suspicions. Were the tender moments enough for you to ignore the glaring plot holes and the terrible voiceover?
Or were they creepy? And until next time, stay spacey.